Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Lover Too Many by Roy Lewis, narrated by Chris McDonnell. Note: please note this book is set in the late 1960s in England, a time before mobile phones and DNA testing, and when social attitudes were very different. Chapter 1. He came out, blinking into the sunshine. Nothing seemed to have changed. There was the usual roar of traffic from the high street, funneling down through the narrow lane. Sunlight lanced black shadows against the walls, slicing the lane in two, black and grey. People were still walking, talking in the high street. Nothing seemed to have changed. Except Peter Marlin. The others had gone. He had been the last to leave. Shirley had gone. She hadn't glanced at him. It was not surprising. He had been conscious of the way people in the courtroom looked sideways at her, and he had no doubt that their eyes reflected the thoughts in their minds. Shirley Walker and Peter Marlin. And Jeanette. He moved away from the doors and paced slowly down through the narrow paved lane towards the high street. It was an old lane, as old as the town, medieval. It hadn't changed. But he had. He must have. How else could he have sat there, outwardly unemotional, when the suggestions were made, the innuendos thrown at him? How was it that he could not bring himself to speak in his defence, in Shirley's defence? More important, when had he changed? Today? Or months ago, when Jeanette had returned? The coroner had, of course, overstepped the mark. "It is not for me to pass comment," Potter had said heavily, "on the moral aspects of the circumstances. It is not for me to suggest that the, affair that seems to have developed between Mr. Marlin and Miss Walker has any bearing on the death of Mrs. Marlin. There is no positive evidence to show that any link exists. We are aware that Mrs. Marlin knew of the affair, that she learned of it shortly after her return. It would seem that the whole thing was over and forgotten for her. She and Mr. Marlin were living together, reasonably amicably. So the evidence does not seem to suggest that the death of Mrs. Marlin would necessarily be important to Mr. Marlin's liaison with Miss Walker. Indeed, there is no evidence to suggest that the relationship between Mr. Marlin and Miss Walker has any connection whatsoever with the death of Mrs. Marlin." In which case, his words were irrelevant. In which case, all the coroner was doing was relaying gossip. But gossip of the worst kind. Gossip that merely started people's minds turning over, thinking about what could have happened, mulling over the possible relationships that could have existed between Shirley Walker and Jeanette and Peter Marlin. Relationship! Between the two women a positive dislike, that was certain. But where did he stand? Where had he stood? Weakly, indecisively. That was the way he had always been, as far as Jeanette was concerned. He turned into the high street and thought briefly of stopping off at the Blue Dragon for a cup of coffee, but then he knew that it was only an excuse for not returning to the office, and he cursed and hurried on. He'd have to go in, walk past Betty's wide eyes, bespectacled, curious behind her typewriter. Walk past Joan's office, the anteroom to his own. They would say nothing, but they would be aware, and after a decent interval, when he'd had time to sit in his leather chair and gnaw at the time, Joan would bring in some papers for signature, a query from a client, a letter to be answered, a problem to be solved. The sooner it was over, the better. Then perhaps things could go back to normal, as if normalcy was what he had ever wanted.
"Peter!"
Marlin stopped and turned his head. Threading away from a small knot of people across the other side of the road was the tall, slim figure of John Sainsby. His arm was raised. Peter waited dully. John was grey-suited, dark-waistcoated as usual. He had the formula white-collar, striped shirt. He moved gracefully, as always, his careful, predatory face pale, his moustache neat and precise and formal. As he trotted to the pavement, his black briefcase clutched in his right hand, he was smiling nervously. Peter moved away, and John Sainsby fell into step beside him. It irritated Peter. John Sainsby always walked in step.
"It's over."
Peter nodded. "All over."
The verdict?
"Murder," said Peter harshly. "By person or persons unknown." Sainsby was quiet for a moment. His mouth puckered under the neat moustache. His shoes echoed Peter's rhythmically.
"There's little I can say," he murmured. "Little that anyone can say now."
"That's right," grunted Peter. Sainsby twitched his cuff free from entanglement with the handle of his briefcase.
"You had Potter as coroner. Did everything go all right?"
Peter quickened his pace in anger.
"You know Potter as well as I, John. You can imagine the hairs he flushed, the irrelevancies he floundered out into open inquest. A really open inquest."
"One of these days," Sainsby said thoughtfully, "someone will be suing him for slander."
"In a coroner's inquest, for statements made in the course of his duty. You know your law better than that, John."
Sainsby's legs were longer than Peter's, but they still marched in unison with his. Sainsby was looking down at them.
"Did he say anything particularly damaging?"
"If you mean, did he drag Shirley Walker into the whole thing?" Peter said bitterly. "The answer is yes.
If you mean, did he hint at the fact that we'd been lovers?"
"Peter, really, I—" "The answer is again, yes. If you mean, will people now be thinking that perhaps I, or Shirley, know more about the whole thing than we pretend, I'm damn sure, again, that the answer will be yes. The blasted man ought to be compulsorily retired."
"He hasn't long to go," soothed Sainsby, his face a little pink.
"For me," grunted Peter, "and for Shirley Walker, it's irrelevant. The damage is done." He turned into Green Street and ran up the steps of Abbey House ahead of John. The sign on the glass doors before him proclaimed in faded gold lettering, "Martin, Sainsby and Sons, Solicitors and Notaries Public, Commissioners for Oaths." The stone face of Abbey House was grimed with age. The offices of Martin, Sainsby and Sons were situated on the first floor. They had always been there, since Abbey House was built in the 1830s. The world around Abbey House and inside it had changed over the years, but Martin, Sainsby and Sons remained. Martin had died in 1880, leaving no heirs, and Sainsby and his two sons had soldiered on. The first son had died a bachelor. When the second son died in 1930, he had left one male heir to carry on. Stephen Sainsby was that son, and he was still there, upstairs, assisted now and being dragged, complaining, into the modern business world by his nephew John Sainsby and Peter Marlin. It was perhaps Stephen Sainsby's impatience with modern business methods and with the changing nature of the pressures of his profession that had caused him to look at other fields of late. He and his family had had a long liberal tradition, locally. His father had spent a few years away from the business in political campaigning, and had succeeded in winning a seat in the Commons for a brief period, before returning to the quiet office when it became apparent that in the Commons his influence upon policy was going to be minimal, and he was in any case unlikely to regain the seat he lost in the general election. But his father's disappointment had not soured Stephen Sainsby's ambitions in that direction. They had lain dormant for most of his life, but now that the firm was showing rising profit margins, and he felt the tug of impatience at its progress, since it was due to no effort on his part, he had begun to fly political kites more positively,
and it was rumoured that preferment was perhaps not too distant. Peter mounted the stairs to the first floor and pushed open the glass-panelled door. As he'd guessed, Betty was sitting there, plump and solid as a fat hen, with her myopic eyes gazing at him from behind her horn-rimmed spectacles. He said nothing to her, raising a hand in brief greeting before turning through the door to the corridor beyond and up the short four-step flight of stairs to the door marked Peter Marlin, LLB, Solicitor of the Supreme Court. He grimaced mentally, as he always grimaced at the sight of the plaque. Stephen thought it good for business that their credentials should be displayed. Peter thought it pompous and unnecessary, but Stephen was the senior partner. In the anteroom, sitting neatly behind her desk, was Joan Shaw. She raised her red head as he came in and smiled. She had good teeth, a good figure, and was remarkably efficient. She had everything a man could need in a secretary. He knew it, and suspected so did she. And like the good secretary she was, she said nothing now as he passed through the red-carpeted room to his own office. There was just the brief smile. No questions, no curiosity. None that showed, anyway. Peter closed his door behind him. It was strange how much safer he felt shut in this room, safer and calmer. Perhaps it was because of the hours he had spent here alone, the hours he had spent hard at work in the early years with the firm until he had become a partner, the longer hours, midnight hours, that he had spent here during the months after Jeanette left him. The room had become so familiar to him, the smell of the leather armchair, the softness of the green carpet, the pale warmth of the magnolia-painted walls, the hard dark wood of the desk, broad, comfortable, executive. Peter grunted to himself, "Executive." He'd never before admitted to himself that buying this desk had been an action dictated by a need to feel that he was really in the executive class. Maybe that was what a working-class background did for you. For Jeanette it had meant other things. But Jeanette was dead. The coroner had said so firmly, and had said other things besides. Real business executives kept bottles of whiskey in a drawer or in a gleaming decanter, cut glass on a shelf. In Peter's drawers there were papers, a dictaphone, clips, a paper punch, rubbish. On his shelves there were books, Curtis and Ruoff on registered conveyancing, Hill and Redmond's Law of the Landlord and Tenant, accounting requirements of the Companies Acts, Stone's Justice's Manual. They marched shoulder to red, black, green, blue and grey shoulder. Drugs that had dulled his sensibilities when Jeanette had left him, far better than whiskey could ever have done. They had befriended him then, in the dark days. They had filled his mind, and they had made him a better lawyer. The room had warmed him and held him, and it comforted him now. It was his, a place to flee to then, and perhaps again now. The leather sighed as he dropped into the armchair. The sky was cloudy. There was an old bird's nest against the drainpipe outside the window. It had been built there when Jeanette was alive. Now it was old and abandoned. The intercom buzzed. Peter flicked the switch and Joan's voice, harshened, impersonalized, gritty, intruded into the silent room. "Mr. Marlin, I have a request from Mr. Gaines that you telephone him this afternoon. Would you like me to make the call now?" This way lay quick forgetfulness. "Yes, please, Joan. Get him for me straight away. And I suppose you have other matters for my attention?"
"I'll bring them in as soon as you've finished your call to Mr. Gaines."
"Thank you." The intercom went dead. Just 3 minutes later, the telephone rang and Peter closed the file he'd been staring at dully to lift the receiver.
"Peter?"
"Hello, Sam. I gather you wanted to have a word with me." "Yes, I rang earlier this morning. I'm sorry, I'd forgotten that you'd be at the coroner's inquest." If he really had, thought Peter, he'd have been the only one in town who had suffered such a lapse of memory. "How did things go?"
"As well as could be expected," replied Peter dryly. There was a short silence.
"I'm sorry, Peter, that was a stupid question. I imagine the verdict was murder by persons unknown."
"It was."
"Yes, anyway, we don't want to talk about that. It's over, finished. I just wanted to have a word with you about the meeting tomorrow. Can you pick me up at Grey Gables? The old lady'll do her nut, but I'm afraid I had a slight contretemps with a lamp post last night."
"Serious?"
"Well, it may add a scar or two, but not where my manly beauty will be affected. The jag is somewhat bent, however. I can count on a lift, then?"
"Of course."
Peter, look, this meeting tomorrow, you know I'm no great shakes at this legal stuff, and I'm just along for the ride at the meeting as a representative of the trust holdings. But what exactly is going on? I don't quite get the picture from the agenda."
Peter hesitated.
It's a long story, Sam. Try me, shortly, in short syllables."
"Well, basically, I suppose it's nothing more than an attempt at a takeover of the companies in which your trust holdings are placed by Amalgamated Industries Limited. Just that."
"And you support the takeover, Peter?"
Again, Peter hesitated. "In principle, yes, I do. As solicitor to the trust, I've looked closely at the deal, and I think that it will do a lot of good for the trust holdings."
"Who's this chap Jackson, Peter?"
Peter went cold.
"Jackson? He's named as the character who'll get a seat in the boards of the trust companies if Amalgamated Industries take over."
"You seem to have read the notices pretty closely," remarked Peter in a controlled tone, "for someone who doesn't know what's going on." Sam Gaines laughed. It was on a high pitch that somehow lacked masculinity, a girl's party laugh. But then Sam went to more than his share of parties.
"I didn't say I hadn't read the papers that came with the agenda, just that I didn't understand them. Do you know this chap Jackson?"
"No. Look, Sam, I'm sorry, but I'm pretty busy at the moment. I think it better that we have a word about it all tomorrow, when I pick you up in the car. Mrs. Gaines well?
Sound as the proverbial ancient bell."
"Right, Peter, my lad, I'll see you tomorrow, and you can give me a rundown on the whole swindle then, okay?" "I'll see you at Grey Gables about 10 a.m.
When Peter replaced the telephone, his hands were damp. A rundown on the whole swindle. Gaines could have chosen his words with more care.
There was a light tap on the door. It was Joan. She came in with a sheaf of papers in her hand. The letters for signature she placed in front of him. He cast his eyes swiftly over them, more by habit than anything else, for he well knew that he could rely on her, and his eyes took nothing into his brain on this occasion. And he was still preoccupied with Gaines's phrase, and his own feeling of discomfort, the quickness of his pulse.
"And there are these three conveyances, Mr. Marlin. They are now due for completion this afternoon. Shall I instruct—"
"Bill," said Peter firmly. Bill Daly was not the most senior legal executive in the firm, but he was the most capable in conveyancing matters. He should have crossed over into articles years ago, but maybe at 38 now he was too old to start. Stephen Sainsby would certainly think so.
"Anything else, Joan?"
She was looking at him carefully when she said,
"Nothing that can't be dealt with without worrying you, Mr. Marlin."
He stared at her, and a slow smile touched his face. She was a better secretary than he deserved.
"I get the message, Joan. You think I ought to take the day off."
"After the coroner's inquest?"
"I think," he interrupted, "that solid work is a better way of forgetting problems than lying back and worrying about them."
"I know."
A silence settled between them. His eyes held hers, and he was aware of their softness. With a slight surge of embarrassment, he realized that their sympathy was for him. Even as the awareness came to him, her precision was back.
"You'll be in and available then, Mr. Marlin? Just one thing. May I leave a little earlier today? You see, I..."
"Be my guest," smiled Peter. "Do you know, Joan, you've been working for me for, what, 5 years? Until now you've never asked to leave early, not once. Explanations aren't necessary. After all, there can't be many more attractive women in town." She had half turned away from him, and he suddenly meant the words more than he'd imagined, as he was aware of the neatness of her figure. Joan Shaw was not tall, nor was she a striking beauty, but her red hair framed an oval face that was well proportioned. Her eyes were friendly, her smile warm. Her figure was unflamboyant, but one a male could appreciate with a positive appreciation.
"Thank you, Mr. Marlin."
"For what?" He was confused as the door closed behind her. "Thanks for the thoughts?" Had they been spoken, or had they stayed in his head? What was in his head? He had looked at Joan differently just now. As a woman? When had he last thought of a woman's body? Jeanette. Jeanette's body. But it had been without life. It had been there at his feet, and the warmth and the life and the loveliness had left it, as it lay sprawled unfashionably on the floor. Unfashionably. How Jeanette would have hated that word. How she would have hated the sight of her own lovely face, twisted, a tongue swollen and bitten between bloodied teeth. She would not have wanted any man, not even Peter, to see her like that. Desperately, Peter turned to his desk and his papers, but concentration evaded him. The papers lay there, solid and positive in the problems they raised. Matrimonial Homes Act 1967. It would be of assistance in the Davis case. Where one spouse is entitled by virtue of Section 2 above to a charge on an estate or interest in a dwelling house, and the charge is registered in accordance with subsection 6 or 7 of that section, it shall be a term of any contract. The words were incomprehensible. They were cloaked by the dark image of a woman's ungainly shape, sprawled in death on a rumpled carpet. It was an image that was put to flight only by the insistent intercom.
"Mr. Marlin, Mr. Stephen would like you to come up to his office as soon as it is convenient."
It was convenient.
"Come in, my boy." Stephen Sainsby's office was the largest on the first floor. Its window overlooked the high street, and the muted sound of traffic drifted through the double glazing like the drone of summer bees. The room was wide, the desk was central. The cupboard containing the whiskey and the sherry and the gin lurked in mahogany splendour in the far corner, and Stephen Sainsby was facing it, his back towards Peter. He was taking out some glasses. Peter raised his eyebrows to John Sainsby, who stood with one nervous hand on his uncle's desk. John knew as well as Peter that the drinks rarely came out for the partners. The occasional influential client was offered something, the partners only when something important was in the wind. John Sainsby made no facial reply to Peter's quizzical eyebrows. He looked away.
"Whiskey, my boy?"
"I think that would be rather pleasant," replied Peter carefully, and walked towards the desk. Over his shoulder, Stephen Sainsby said, "Take a seat, Peter, take a seat." Peter did as he was told. He observed Stephen Sainsby, as the senior partner, poured the drinks. The man was 58 now, but presented an upright, handsome figure, and his waist was trim. He went to a good tailor, as the cut of his grey suit showed. His hairdresser charged the highest prices in town, and Stephen's white hair gave him a distinguished appearance, swept back carefully, trimmed neatly at the nape of the neck, the merest hint of sideburns.
His lean, ascetic face was profiled to Peter and lined with concentration as he poured the drink, gold in the faceted glass. Stephen Sainsby did everything with concentration, and he had often insisted to Peter and John it always paid dividends. He was turning now, proffering the glass to Peter, an inch of white shirt cuff displayed, long, lean, hard fingers holding the glass lightly.
"A dash of soda?"
Peter agreed.
"I'll have the same, Uncle. I thought you would do so."
John sat down across from Peter. Stephen Sainsby elegantly perched himself on the edge of his desk, one leg swinging in smartly creased grey flannel. He raised his glass, and his smile showed the slightly age-stained teeth of his lower jaw, contrasting with the bleached dentures above.
"Peter, John, your health," he said softly, "and the health of the firm."
The whisky was warm in Peter's throat. He was suddenly aware that he had needed it all morning. He took a second sip, more slowly. Stephen Sainsby was not looking at him, but at the glass which he had placed on the desk.
"Do you know, I've been in this firm all my life, Peter." "That's silly. Of course you do. You know its history as well as I. You know how I came in at 16, took articles and qualified, saw the others die. And then there was John, and there was you."
He paused ruminatively.
"Just 40 years. You know, Peter, it's a strange thing. I've seen this firm as a living entity, and I've seen it grow from a solid, respected business into an efficient, modern one, and I've seen where the credit for that lay."
Peter could not suppress the glance of surprise in John's direction. John's head was bent, staring into his glass. There they both were, uncle and nephew, gazing in rapt concentration at puddles of whiskey in cut glass tumblers.
"It's lain with you two youngsters. You two boys came into this firm, John as a partner, you as an assistant, and then later as a partner, and by dint of your efforts, and I admit here that I was of little assistance to you, but then old dogs abhor new tricks. You dragged this firm out into the harsh sunlight of modern business techniques."
It was unlike Stephen Sainsby. Peter wondered vaguely if he was rehearsing political speeches and phraseology, but a warning ticked through his brain.
"And we saw the results in the rising profit margins, the increased business from commerce in the area, the new respect that appeared in the industrial community. True, the kind of business that we were transacting was changing in its character. The old family firm of former days was disappearing as such, but who could argue against such progress? I watched and I wondered, and in the end, for all my opposition and the difficulties I raised, I knew. I knew that you and John, you both had the interests of the firm at heart. You wanted what was best for the firm. You had, in a word, come to look upon the firm as I had always looked upon it, as an entity, as something alive and worth preserving."
Stephen raised his glass and took a slow drink. He turned his head and his eyes were benign as they looked into Peter's, but his mouth was brutal.
"And if you stay with the firm, Peter, you'll kill it."
Peter's skin was cold. John's head had jerked, as though away from a knife, but he had not looked up. He had known what was coming. It was just the method of presentation that had surprised him.
"What the hell are you talking about, Stephen?"
Peter's tone was calm and even. This surprised him. Nothing surprised Stephen Sainsby.
"It is quite clear, Peter. The way you and John have worked in this firm makes it clear to me that you have a great respect for its traditions. You have regarded it in the same light as I. You may not realize, Peter, that I was fully aware of the time you put into the business, of the long evenings at your desk. You may not realize that—"
"Stop wrapping it up in cotton wool.
cut in Peter. "Get to the point."
Stephen's tone remained smooth. "The point is quite clear. I know the regard you must have for the firm. I know that you will..."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?